Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
You probably know I'm a heavy metal fan. I grew up on Iron Maiden and Metallica, and I love heavy metal. So a bunch of people told me that I needed to read this book by this guy who I'd heard of in the news. I think many people heard this story. Basically, he's the lead singer of this dark heavy metal band, and a fan dies at one of his shows, falling off the stage. Things like that happen tragically at shows, and he goes on with his life. But then years later, he's arrested and thrown in a Czech prison and charged with the death of this person. And he ended up writing an incredible memoir about it that was actually represented by an agent who's a friend of mine, Mark Gerald, who's worked with Robert Greene as well and a bunch of other cool people. I didn't know much about it. I hadn't gotten around to reading the book. Obviously, I was familiar with the band Lamb of God and listened to some of their stuff. It was just sort of existing vaguely in the back of my mind. And then we had a benefit here at the Painted Porch a couple months back, and a guy came in. His name is Curse, a very fitting name. And Curse said, hey, you should meet my friend Randy. And he said, you might know him. He's the lead singer of Lamb of God. And it all clicked. And I emailed Mark Gerald, the friend, our mutual friend, and said, hey, I just met a friend of Randy's. And he said, you got to have him on the podcast. Curse said the same thing. Randy came in to the bookstore a couple months ago. We spent some time talking about writing and life, and it turns out he is a huge fan of Stoicism. Literally almost every day he shares a quote from one of the Stoics on his Instagram, which you can follow at Dr. Randall Bly, B-L-Y-T-H-E. But anyways, as it happens, he wasn't just a recent student of Stoicism, but had been studying the Stoics, particularly Epictetus, before his life was turned upside down when he was indicted on manslaughter charges in the Czech Republic. Ultimately, he was vindicated. The Czech court held that the liability for the death lay with the promoters and security members, and ultimately they acquitted him on the charges. But you can imagine watching your life flip upside down that way. And it's sort of a Stoic thing, right? Through something no fault of your own or not entirely your fault, and suddenly fate puts you in a position that many of the Stoics were experiencing, whether it's exile for Epictetus or Musonius Rufus, whether it's trumped up charges in the case of Rutilius Rufus. And how do you get through that? How do you face imprisonment, although not for as long, but as Admiral Stockdale did as well? So we talk all about that in this wonderful interview. I was really hoping to go see Lamb of God play with Megadeth here when they were in Austin. It was right in the middle of the Delta surge, and I didn't feel right about it with the kids, so I didn't go. I've been very impressed with some of the stands that Randy's taken, COVID protocols at the event, and then after the tragic events at the concert in Houston, some taking a stand, and you can speak from experience on this, on crowd safety at events and how to communicate. We get into all of that in the show. I highly recommend his book, Dark Days, a memoir. And I am looking forward to the sequel, which he tells me he is working on. And I really enjoyed this conversation. He is a sweet guy. If you're not interested in heavy metal at all, don't worry about it. That's not the topic of this conversation. I think you'll like this interview. Good to see you, man.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm doing excellent. I'm really excited to do this. You feel relaxed and replenished after the tour, after your downtime after the tour?
Not a lot of downtime since the, you know, we're not on the road, but
right,
you know, always working on things. So yeah.
I think, did you find from the pandemic that you got much more used to being home? Like, for me, it's like, now I can't comprehend how much I used to travel and then how integrated the disruption of it, I became.
With this disruption of travel?
Yeah. Like, just like,
how used I
got very familiarized with the craziness of being on the road, home sometimes, not set, just like going a mile a minute. And now when I go travel, I go do something, I come back, I'm like, I got to take like 3 days to recover from this.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very weird tour. You know what I mean? Like everything was so restrictive, and the sort of camaraderie that you experience, particularly with other bands on the road, was fairly non-existent. I mean, we talked to each other outside our buses, but we weren't hanging out in each other's dressing rooms and all that other stuff. So it was a very sort of oddly connected, but extremely isolated at the same time.
Feeling. You were siloed.
Yeah, exactly. In front of thousands of people every night. So yeah. it was very bizarre. And I'm still kind of trying to make sense of it all. As far as the traveling thing and it sort of wearing on me, like we're going to Miami. I mean, not Miami. We're going to Fort Lauderdale tomorrow morning. We have one gig. I'll get up and go to the airport and leave at like 8 and go to this big festival in Florida for one day and turn around and come back. And I'm already kind of like, ugh, because I just went to Florida for a 24-hour trip last week for a photo shoot. So it was really weird. You know, it's very... What was so commonplace for me is just like, get up and go. I noticed before this last tour, one thing I noticed there was a difference is it took me a lot longer to pack.
Yes.
Right. For it was 7 weeks. And I quite literally before the pandemic, I'm so used to, I can leave for 2 months hitting every different climate possible, you know, because we've done this, you know, Finland in the winter, and then you're in Australia or whatever. So you have to bring all possible sorts of clothes. You know, I could do that in an hour. And this time I'm just like, oh my God, I need this. I gotta have my toothbrush. I just all these things that you're used to just having at home at your ready disposal.
Yeah. Like so, I found like, I used to be able to work really well on planes and now I'm like, what happened? I used to be able to speak this language and now I can't speak the language anymore. And there's part of me that's like, oh, did I lose something? And then another part of me is like, no, I'm probably used to a year and a half at home operating on a more locked in frequency. And now I'm sitting around, I'm like, this is not a conducive environment to productive, creative work. This is
right. You used to be able to write on planes. You're one of those guys, right? See, I've never, ever, ever been that guy for some reason. I wish, I have this total romantic fascination with the lost generation, as Gertrude Stein described it, to the point that, you know, I've traveled the left bank of Paris and the Quartier Latin, hitting every, you know, cafe and bookstore and place where Hemingway, you know, farted or whatever, just so I could be there, you know. And I have this romantic sort of vision of him and other people working in the cafes and writing and journaling and all this stuff. And I've tried to do that and I fail miserably every single time. I cannot have anyone around me when I'm writing. And the plane is like, even if nobody's looking, I feel their presence. You know?
Totally get it. Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the tour, but let's do that at the end. Okay. Let's start with, okay. So, do you know who James Stockdale is?
Yes, of course. So
he wrote this book after his time in the POW camp in Vietnam. And it was sort of it's called Courage Under Fire, but the subtitle is Testing Epictetus's Doctrine in the Laboratory of Human Experience.
Yes, I own it. It's very short.
Yes, it's almost a pamphlet, basically.
Yes, I read it two or three months ago. I got it.
Oh, did you get it at the Painted Porch? Is that where you got it by chance? Because I knew you were here. I wondered if we carry it. I've never seen it physically anywhere.
Maybe no, I didn't. I didn't get it at the Painted Porch. I'd ordered it online. I already had it before I came to the Painted Porch.
So it's a delightful little book. But I love it because it's like, here you have this guy who studied philosophy. Then he goes and experiences this horrible thing. And then he sort of is like, well, now I can tell you whether this philosophy holds up or not, right?
Right. Under real life, you know, live fire conditions.
Exactly. Now, your experience is a little bit different, but I wanted to start there. Where, as someone who studied philosophy, done a lot of work on yourself, both before and after, what is spending time in a Czech prison teach you about this stuff, right? Like, how have you found that these ideas or any of the things that you've learned stood up to the laboratory that you found yourself trapped in for, I don't even remember exactly how long, but how did it stand up?
I think, first of all, can I mention how I found out about Stoicism?
Of course. Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a secret that I'm an alcoholic. I happen to be one who's been sober for 11 years now, you know? But yeah, I drank and drugged and partied like musicians do. I gave it a Herculean effort for 22 years.
You did your best.
I did my best. I gave it the old college dropout try, right? And it just didn't work out for me in the end. I was just miserable and I wanted to die. But towards the end of my drinking, I was looking for some sort of answer other than the one that is obviously staring me in the face, like, hey, you're an alcoholic, you got to stop. I went to go see a shrink. This counselor, his name is Ted. I wish I could remember his last name because I think I still owe him money from our last session. But I was going to him and I was still drinking at the time and I was complaining a lot about, you know, problems I was having in my relationship, with my work, and, you know, all of this is stemming from my alcoholism. But he's being cool and he's trying to kind of deal with me without directly saying, you got to get sober, dude, you know? Because I was kind of beating around the bush with him. He's like, I want to, do you know who Epictetus is? And I'm like, no. He's like, he is a philosopher of the school of Stoicism. You know, he was a slave and he wrote this book called the Enchiridion or the Manual. And I forget which translation he had. I think it's a newer one by a woman.
Sharon LaBelle. I had her on the podcast. Yes.
Yes.
The Art
yes.
of Living.
Yes. That's the one. Yeah. So it's on my shelf over there. So I bought it. And I was reading it and it was making sense, but because I was still deep within the throes of my alcoholism, I could not internalize and really apply the lessons there. But the seed was planted, you know? And then a few years later, when I got sober, I picked Epictetus back up, you know? So that was probably pretty early into my first year of sobriety, you know? And when I got arrested, I was about a year and a half sober. So I think for me, I don't think it was so much I've studied some meditation techniques via Zen Buddhism as well. Soto Zen Buddhism. My friend Brad Warner is a Buddhist teacher in that school. And that sitting still and recognizing reality, that came from sort of meditation, that practice that served me well. Reading some of Epictetus at that time, I hadn't gotten into Marcus Aurelius or Seneca yet, but reading Epictetus and trying to, I think I internalized some of like his external conditions did not define his emotional state. Cause he, right. You know, was a slave who was, we don't know to what degree, crippled, I suppose. And thinking about that and thinking about the end of my drinking, where I was so miserable and just wanted to die when I was in prison, I was like, this sucks, right? There's no way around it. This is not a good time. And it's very scary and all that other stuff. But I at least want to live. I at least want to sort of make the best of this situation. Whereas a year and a half ago, I didn't care if I lived or died. So there's like these
the little things.
Yeah, the little things became extremely important in prison. But I wrote a friend of mine from prison where I was like, I would rather do another 5 or 10 years in here than drink again, because I think I can survive 5 or 10 years in here. You never know, but I think I can do it. But I'm pretty sure I would not survive another round with alcoholism. You know, I'd blow my brains out or someone would kill me or something like that. So I tried to remain grateful for like the things I had rather than becoming resentful for the things I didn't have, you know? And I think that's kind of a key for me to regulate my, my emotional temperature, I suppose, most of the time when I'm good, when I actually sit back and do that. I fail at it miserably a lot, I think.
Of course, we all do.
But I try at least, you know.
So the timeline is you were introduced to the Stoics. You're struggling with sobriety. You start to get sober, and then this all happens. So you're carrying that into what must have been a surreal, bewildering, I need a drink series of moments over like a year and a half.
Right. Yes. Yes, that's what definitely, but I would not characterize it as I need a drink. I mean, maybe for normal people, I think that was a big fear of my friends, my family, my business associates there. I know it was because they told me they were worried I was going to drink. And honestly, it was the last thing on my mind because I was like, I don't know what's going to happen in here. I don't have a crystal ball. I have to stay present. I have to stay in the moment. But I do know that if I get drunk, it's definitely not going to help things at all. Because I have proven that with 22 years of hard research, right? I'm a knucklehead. So I did 2 decades. I think it's safe to assume that I could, you know, with great confidence say that drinking, you know, is not only not going to solve my problems, it's going to make things worse.
Sure.
You know, so
how does the philosophy hold up then? I mean, you hadn't spent years studying it, but mm-mm. Suddenly your freedom is taken from you, and not that dissimilar to the way Epictetus or Stockdale or right. any of the Stoics who sort of experience this kind of severe adversity. How does it stand up?
It does. It stands up 100%. I'm not going to say that I was like this bodhisattva like figure of calm in prison at all times, you know, because I just wasn't. But I was facing a very uncertain future. But the sort of philosophy of embracing your current circumstances and not trying to I don't know, wish futilely that you were anywhere but where you are right at that moment. It works so well. You know, I saw people in there who were miserable, always thinking, oh, you know, this person did me wrong and that's why I'm here. And, or conversely, constantly projecting in the future, when I get out of here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And I'm like, I have to take care of right here, right now, you know? Cause that's all that really exists. If I have one foot in the past and one foot in the future, I'm pissing on the present. And even though right now sucks, you know, I have to address my situation right now. And I have to be cognizant of the fact that A, I'm not in, like, let's say Afghanistan or something, getting shot at, you know. I have a roof over my head. Is it leaky and 137 years old? Yes. I have food. Is it terrible? Yes.
but it's not, like, Stockdale's prison.
It's
or
not
Epictetus's prison.
Yes. No, it's not. And, you know, I have, you know, I know guys who did a lot more time than me and they came out and survived it, you know. And I have a lot of friends that I always bring up, like, you know, as I just did, like Afghanistan or something. I have friends in gone through some horrific stuff in the military, you know. It's like, it wasn't a good time for me, but I know people who have been through worse, you know, and that gives me sort of grounding in the state of my current reality. That's one of the things that has annoyed me the most about this freaking pandemic and the news cycle and so forth is I wish we could make this term outlawed until everybody promises to use it correctly, which is unprecedented. The term unprecedented. And these unprecedented times,
they're very precedented.
They're entirely precedented. you know, in the last 100 years. Even
exactly
the violent,
100 years.
The violent toilet paper hoarders. We had that in the 70s, you know, during the gas shortage. Johnny Carson made a joke on TV. He's like, oh, you know what else we're short on? Toilet paper. That set off a 4-month toilet paper hoarding spree. There were fights in the grocery store.
Sure.
This is ridiculous. So this, I think this feeling of like these people, a lot of people, and the media doesn't help, these unprecedented times, it's not to me, because I was raised by a grandmother who was raised during the Depression. And I was constantly reminded that I didn't know what hard times were, you know, stuff is, I grew up with stories like that. So it's not unprecedented.
Well, your situation tragically is not only not unprecedented, it's not uncommon, right? Mm. The fact that it happened to a musician for something that happened while they were performing on stage was a little unusual.
Yes.
I mean, prisons are filled with people in precisely your situation, tragically.
Yes.
But
yes,
there's dozens of memoirs about specifically what you were going through.
Yes, 100%. You know, mine just got a little attention right from the beginning because I'm a fairly well-known musician. You know, that's the only other thing. But I mean, what was the most common question, I guess, when I got out? Like, was it like Midnight Express? You know, the guy who went to the Turkish prison or whatever.
I'm like,
no, it wasn't that bad. It was pretty bad, but it wasn't that bad. You know, I got to give you that.
Well, I wrote down 4 emotions that I suspect you would have experienced, or that I suspect I would experience if I was in your situation. I'd love to know how you processed them or thought about them while you're there. So the first, I guess it's not really an emotion, but this sense of unfairness, right? Why me? This isn't right. It shouldn't have happened to me. How do you process that feeling, which I imagine must have been a pretty straightforward one?
I think perhaps there was some of that. You know, like, this sucks. Why me? And there was a sort of political aspect to the situation for sure, with the prosecuting attorney particularly. I think there was some of that, but not really that much. I was too worried about trying to do the right thing for myself and for the situation in the time, and not do anything that would make the situation worse.
Sure.
I think it was just so, like, I think it was just so abrupt and such a reality check that it wasn't really like, why did this happen to me? You know? And in fact, you know, in thinking precisely about the specifics, and I've talked to a bunch of other musicians when I got out, I mean, we had security protocols in place, a contract, all this other stuff that was not met. The whole thing was a tragic accident, one that I carry with me till I'm dead. This is something, you know, but it was something that was kind of waiting to happen sooner or later. It just was. And so I know.
Just fell on you.
Yeah. I told a bunch of my musician friends are like, damn, dude, you caught the bullet. And I'm like, yes, everybody pay attention. Like, lock, make sure security is tight. Make sure the barricades are placed correct. Everybody. And I, you know, a lot of people paid a lot of attention to that, you know? So I don't think it was so much why me. I was a little too worried about trying to do the correct thing in this situation.
So what about fear, right? What's going to happen to me? What could happen to me in prison? You know, how did you deal with the fear?
You know, sometime it was a minute to minute thing. I mean, it's scary. I was the top news story in that country for a while. And I went first to a jail, the city jail for 3 days. And then they sent me to prison for 37, I think, Pancrats prison. And the first time I walked into the cell block, everybody, they were lining people up, everybody went and looked at me. You know, it's like, it was like a scene in the movie and everyone there knew who I was because I was a news story, you right. know? So it was pretty scary. I think I just tried to take things 1 minute at a time. And that's something I learned in sobriety, right? In getting sober, because when you first get sober, and it's a cliche, you hear it say one day at a time, you know, when that worked, it was an invaluable tool for me in prison in handling fear. And sometimes it's just 1 minute at a time. Like, here's this new situation. I'm not going to try and project, too many catastrophic outcomes upon this. If I can, I'm just going to handle this 1 second at a time. So, there was that sort of trying to stay in the moment and not catastrophize everything, you know? And then there was also, because, you know, for lack of a better term, I believe in a God or a higher power. I'm not talking about, you know, the dude in the robes, the Judeo-Christian or whatever tradition. I just believe in some sort of higher power. And I constantly was talking to that higher power and not saying, please get me out of this, because I didn't know what the truth of the situation was. I was curious too, because this was an incident that happened 2 years previous that I had no memory of, that we didn't know anything had happened. But I was asking, you know, God, for lack of a better term, I'm like, just give me the strength to get through this with dignity. And I didn't ask for a specific, outcome. I'm like, just give me the strength to get through this with some dignity, no matter what the outcome is.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher
I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80. That's 80 to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
So what about anger? Like, this is a little related to the unfairness, but what about anger? I'm sure there was frustration at the injustice of it, or
there was definitely most of the people, nobody in the prison messed with me. First of all, they all knew why I was there, and they were like, "Oh, this is like money. This is political stuff," you know. But there were some guards there who were not cool, like not cool guys. And like, I really had to watch my temper around them. And because you like, you know, acting out and fighting a prison guard just doesn't end well. It just sure. doesn't end well for you. You know, it never does. No matter how much of an asshole they are. So I really was cognizant of that around a couple of people. As far as the anger, it was, I mean, there was some of that, you know, but I think everything relates to me through the lens of my alcoholism. Right. And I learned that I cannot really afford to sit in anger. Like, everybody gets angry over things, you know. Somebody does something, and people should get angry over some things, but for me and my situation, if I were to get angry and just sit and angry, this sucks. Why are they, you know, why have they doubled my bail? Which they did. You make bail and then they double it. That's not how it works here, you know?
Yeah.
I can be angry about it and then just sit there and be angry. Or I can, you know, let that pass through me and try and be a little bit more productive. And that's what I really tried to be in prison, was productive. And actually enjoyed it. I wrote about it in my book, and some people are kind of bummed about it, but I found that I actually enjoyed moments of stillness in prison. I was like, what is going on? I'm actually kind of happy right now. And it's like, oh yeah, you aren't on tour, constantly going, and it locked me into a specific place. You know, everything I tried to focus on involved gratitude, basically, you know, and that helped me fight fear and anger and uncertainty. It's just like trying to remain grateful for what I had rather than resentful for what I didn't have, you know?
What about guilt and sadness about what had happened? How did you deal with, I'm thinking about this with like the Alec Baldwin situation, like something happens, you're there. How do you, whether or not you accept, I'm not talking about you specifically, but whether one takes full responsibility for something or not, or blame for it, mm-hmm. it still doesn't change that it happened and there would be feelings about that.
Right. Yes, that is definitely true. And that's a sort of complex, how do you deal with that? It's a complex topic. I mean, for me, first of all, it was most important for me to find out to the best of my ability exactly what had happened, right? Because a young fan of my band had died as a result of an injury, you know, at this show. And people, there were, the family of this young man just wanted to know what had happened to their son, right? Who wouldn't? You're a parent. If something happened to your kid, they never came at me in the press. They never attacked me. I got really lucky because I don't know if I would have been that level-headed, you know?
If the shoe was on the other foot.
Yeah. You know, they didn't, I got exceedingly lucky. And I decided that no matter what happened, I was going to do my best to provide these people with an answer to the best of my ability, to the best of my memory of what had happened that night 2 years previously. You know, I played thousands of shows. It's like, most people can't tell me, oh, what did you do on Wednesday night 2 years ago at between 7 and 8:30 PM?
Right.
You know,
while you were in some sort of flow state.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. While you're working, like, it's crazy. So, but there were so many different rumors and so forth, that I was like, you know, I need to find out to the best of my ability. I'm pretty sure I never tried to hurt anyone. Cause that's, why would I? That's our fan, right. You know, that's moronic. But what if I, for me, I don't want to say curiosity, intellectual curiosity, but there was a need to know if somebody had brought some sort of evidence or truth that said, you know, hey, you did this on purpose and I somehow spaced it, then I would have to be willing to accept responsibility. So I decided, you know, if I'm going to face myself in the mirror and call myself a good man, an accountable man, I'm going to do my best to provide these people with these answers. And that's what I did. You know, I got out on bail and we went on tour to try and pay for my 5 different lawyers and then went back to trial twice, you know, and luckily was found not guilty. The thing for me, how do I deal with it is like, I had a talk with the family of this young man after I was found not guilty. They wanted to talk with me and the young man's mother and his uncle. And a lot of the stuff we discuss is private. You know, I'm not going to bring that. But one thing that the uncle said to me that I know is they would be happy. And I've spoke on this before. He goes, hey, dude, remember, you can be a spokesperson for Safer Shows. You can help make this happen. You know, so this doesn't happen. And I view that as a responsibility, you know? And for me, one way of dealing with the emotions, and of course there's feelings of guilt. And even though it's a terrible accident, of course, you know,
sure. If someone ran in front of your car, even if you weren't to blame, you would feel guilty.
Yeah. And you feel that to some degree, or at least passes my mind daily. You know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about what happened in that young man. But for me, one way of dealing that is to get myself into a course of action, a positive course of action to try and help people, or to, you know, to speak on, you know, make sure that these sort of events are safer, you know, at least in our end. And tragically,
it just happened last week.
Yeah. And that was, you know, pardon my French, but that was a clusterfuck. And, you know, I have a lot of opinions on what happened, and not all of it is because I'm not going to armchair quarterback the whole situation because I wasn't there. And I know how rough it is to be on stage and not be able to see what's going on. But I do know that just like in my situation, I should have stopped the show that we played. That's where I accept the responsibility. I should have stopped this fucking show because it was dangerous. And we did stop and did tell people don't get on stage. And then it kept happening and kept happening. I should have walked off stage. That's what should have happened in Houston, you know, because the fire marshal of Houston said the one person who has the power really to de-escalate, to stop this in a tactical sense is the performer, the guy with the mic, you know, and he was absolutely correct. So, and, you know, just as I should have just said, we're done and walked off. I think in that situation, he could have at least said, hey, we're stopping playing now. Lights are coming up. Everybody back up. Cause it was obvious something was wrong. You know, I mean, there's the worry of causing a riot. Believe me, I've been there, you know, but there's also a way to, you have a microphone. There's also a way to control the situation, you know?
We talked about Bruce Dickinson when you visited, but there's a great Iron Maiden clip where he stops a show in the middle because people are beating the shit out of each other and it's falling apart. And you have a certain amount of power there with the microphone, but it also takes courage and focus and empathy to be able to be like, people are going to hate me for this, but I got to do what I think is right.
Yes.
The responsible thing is.
We have done that, and we have stopped shows. You know, our band has been around for like 27 years now. I've been in the band 26, you know. We have stopped shows because of fights, because of injuries, because of people grabbing girls, crowd surfing inappropriately. We've been doing this forever, since before, you know, anything happened with me and I went to prison. And there's, you know, it's just something, if you know how to like address the crowd and say, hey, you know, like, stop, let's help these people. Because if you were down, wouldn't you want someone to help you? And people are like, oh, okay. You know, anyway, to get back to our point, I kind of, you know, I view that as my responsibility if I'm going to play in front of these large crowds of people. And that is one way that I sort of temper my emotions around what happened. You know, I'm proactive about
it. Well, I think that's really interesting, because the process you talked about of like, I'm going to see what happened. I'm going to go through this. And then based on the evidence or the information, I'm going to decide, you know, what I owe society or these people, what my level of sort of guilt or responsibility is. The interesting part of that is how intention our self-interest from our obligation can be, right? There's that famous Upton Sinclair line where he says, it's hard to get someone to understand something when their salary depends on them not understanding it.
Yeah,
I've got to imagine... It's hard to get someone to understand something when their freedom potentially depends on them not understanding it. So I imagine you probably felt like the idea of like, I'm an open book, let's get to the bottom of this. There must have been a part of you that was also like, that's a very vulnerable place to be, because what it means is you're not saying, I'm going to fight this and protect myself from the consequences no matter what. Right? Like there's a tension between what the best legal strategy is and what the best, like being the best person strategy is. And I imagine you wrestled with that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good analysis of the situation, actually. I mean,
it's why they tell you not to take the stand in your own defense, right?
Right.
It's
but here's, let me explain something to you about the way the courts work in the Czech Republic. It's different, right? So there's three judges. There's a professional judge and then two lay judges who are like jurors, right? So, you know, a majority vote, the two lay judges can vote against the professional judge and it'll still go. Most of the time though, the lay judges vote along with the professional judge. And it's an older legal system. Because up until 1989, the Czech Republic was Czechoslovakia. It was country. It was a communist country, you know, and then they had what they called the Velvet Revolution as the Iron Curtain fell down. So there, it's an older court system. I can't remember exactly the name of it, but there's a lot of, I don't know. These were people that were raised during communist era Russia. And so we had to explain things to them like, what does moshing mean? What does crowd surfing mean? These are people who grew up not in a heavy metal scene, right? Sure. They had no clue of what all that meant. So there was all this sort of like video documentation that we presented, like, this is what a concert is like, because of these people, the outside untrained eye, it probably just looks like some sort of demonic sacrifice or something, right. You know? It was part of like my legal strategy that I formulated with the team is to be as honest as possible and explain the reality of what one of these shows is like. And I said prior to them reading the sentence, you know, the decision, I was like, I do not wish to avoid any responsibility that I may hold in this matter, because I didn't, but I do not believe that I am guilty of the charge that was, you know, I've been charged with, the crime I've been charged with. And it worked, you know, like these people, I think they saw that I was, I hate to use the word intellectually curious, but I was interested in finding out the truth of the matter. You know what I mean? Because I didn't want to avoid responsibility, because I wouldn't be able to look at myself in the mirror in the morning. And it wasn't like I got a parking ticket, You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I'm not going back to Colorado for a few years because I have a parking ticket. It's like, this is serious business. I have to deal with this. And I think I just told the truth and it worked, you know? It wasn't like, I don't know, it didn't try to color anything in an unrealistic manner, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes total sense. So let's go back to the sobriety thing, because I've always been interested in that. Why do you think, and I don't know if it's actually based on statistics, but it does seem to be an impression. You said you were sort of drugged and partied like a professional.
Like a rock star.
What is it about the creative professions that seems to either bring that out or attract or enable that tendency?
Well, it definitely enables it, and it's particularly in heavy metal. I mean, as long as you can get your ass up on stage and not make too much of a disgrace against you, it's expected that you're going to party. I think that sort of paradigm is shifting. I think younger people are realizing more and more that it's not cool to be a junked out mess.
It's a bad business decision.
Yes, it's bad. It really is. It definitely enables that, though, you know, it just does, because it's expected. As far as like it attracting that the artist, I guess, the sort of cultural myth of the artist as a drug addict or as an alcoholic, that exists, right? It certainly exists. And a lot of people buy into it, including I did myself. Sure. For many years, not just in the music thing, but as far as writing, right? I was like any other angst ridden 20 something. I'm big.
The Hemingway.
Hemingway, dude. Love Hemingway. Love Bukowski. Love Hunter S. Thompson, you know, and all these guys are hard drinking, hard partying guys. And so, you know, I did all that. I drank, I womanized, I partied, I got in some fights. I did everything that those guys did except for sit down and write, you know, I was getting ready. So, there's like the sort of cultural mythos that sells that. And I think a lot of it, maybe at the one reason why it's so prevalent beyond it, like that's sort of expected and there's this cultural sort of mythos around it. I think a lot of it is that it's a cliche, but a lot of art comes out of pain, right? Mm-hmm. I know it has for me. And one way that people treat pain is they medicate themselves, you know? So I think there could be sort of that part of it too, you know?
Yeah. It's like, you think, hey, so it's like the pain partly is what makes you creative. The pain's also what makes you driven to achieve, mm-hmm. and get adulation and recognition. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a part of you that thinks, oh, once I get it, the pain will go away.
Right.
Right. Because now I'm famous. Now I've performed for millions of people. Now I have fans. And, mm-hmm. and it's not only not true, but also the lifestyle's a grind. And you mm-hmm. need something just to get you through the grind of a 7-month tour or a 2.5 yes. year tour. And so it's sort of a wicked cycle where you bring something to it. It doesn't solve your problem, and it exacerbates the problem because you live an untethered existence.
Yes. You know, alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was my solution. Regrettably, is a very ineffective solution after a while. You know, I had some good times drinking. I didn't immediately have a beer and then, you know, turn into a bum in a trench coat, urine stained pants beneath a bridge somewhere. You know, I worked hard to get where I was. But I viewed alcohol as a way, it was a way to quiet the voices in my head that I hadn't learned how to cope with. And a lot of anger at the way the world is, you know, a lot of quote unquote justified anger, you know, that just became overwhelming because the world was not behaving as I wanted it to, you know. I had a lot of expectations. Why can't people just be cool. Why can't they behave in an ethical manner? Why do they have to do this? Why, you know, all these expectations, and expectations are just premeditated resentments, you know? So
don't you think that, part of what makes someone a good athlete or a good musician or a good inventor or sculptor or whatever it is sort of a compulsiveness, right? Like I can't not write. And when I don't write, it's painful, right? And the desire to fiddle and return over and over again till you get something exactly right is inherently a compulsive behavior, just as any addiction is a compulsive behavior, just as whatever you're vaping is probably a you have a compulsive thing, and it's that the last you.
The last of my vices, the nicotine.
It's soothing, you know? Yeah.
It's a son of a bitch.
It soothes the existential and physical distress.
Yes. I think, you know, as far as like for me as a creative person, I do not, if I do not create, you're right, it is compulsive in one way or the other, whether it be photography, writing, or music. If I am not creating a lot, then I get very restless and very irritable and very discontent. And I think that's because for me, making art is my way of understanding my life in that moment of creation. It's kind of how I understand myself. It's how I process all the stuff that is coming at me. And I'm like, okay, I'm feeling this because of this. And I can turn it into a song or an article or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So it's how I understand life, you know?
And how you get through life.
Yes, precisely. So
I was talking to my friend Tank Sinatra. He's like a meme guy.
He was
saying the other day he was talking to someone. He has like 20 years sober or something. And he was saying that he was talking to someone. He's like, look, some people drink away the pain. Some people screw away the pain. Some people smoke away the pain. You know, some people work away the pain. And he said the person just looked at him and she said, what pain? You know, and to me, that's the distinction. I was trying to just talk to my wife about that. It's like a normal person who doesn't have the wound or the pain. Mm-hmm. It's incomprehensible why you would need to do any of these things.
Right.
Because it's a solution to a problem that they do not have.
Right. Right. Yeah. Not everybody is as screwed up as me. I have to realize that. I have to be cognizant of that fact, you know, that there are normal, well-adjusted folks out there. That being said, most of the people I surround myself with in one way or the other are off kilter some, you know. Yes. That's why I feel at home around them, I suppose. You know, I really wouldn't know what to do in a crowd of a bunch of people. Nobody's ever been arrested or divorced or, you know, some sort of horrible traumatic event hasn't happened to them, you know? But those people exist. I don't understand that. The woman said, what pain? It's just like, I don't understand how someone can just have one beer. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Like I know people can do it. I know it's possible. I've watched it happen many times, but it's just like, why, how can you do that? Why, you know, I want it all.
Yeah.
You know? It's that compulsive thing, you know?
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah. It's just a hand that we get dealt, and then we have to figure out, once it becomes clear that you can't do it moderately, you have to do it not at all.
Right. 100%. And, you know, I don't think I made myself an alcoholic, right? I didn't, when I was a little kid, I didn't say, you know what, I want to grow up and be an alcoholic and ruin my fucking relationships and worry my family and everybody. I think, for whatever reason, I just happened to get that, you know? So I don't think it's my fault, I am person, it is my responsibility to deal with it. And I think that's with anyone and their problems in life, whatever hand fate has dealt them, you know, you can't bemoan it, but so much there comes a point where you have to say, okay, I have this problem. What am I going to do about it? What am I going to do with this problem? How am I going to find a way to live with this?
It's not your fault, but it's still your problem.
Yeah, it's your problem, you know? Like, it sucks, but I feel bad for anyone who has any sort of difficulty, but that's your problem. That's your responsibility to deal with. It's your life. I can't live it for you. No one can.
Well, this idea of responsibility is sort of where I wanted to end up. We don't have to talk about specific people if you don't want to, but I found it interesting during COVID. You're talking about the power of the musician on stage with the mic, right? You might not have the most authority, but you've got the most power, right? Or you might not have legal accountability for what you're doing, but you still have a certain obligation, right?
Right.
It's been interesting to me in COVID, all different types of businesses, public figures, people, et cetera. And I think you and I are relatively aligned on this, but you can disagree if you don't. But people have just sort of said, like, what do I owe other people? What do I owe society? Right. This is my job, for instance, is to go around performing indoors with large amounts of people smashed together. Why should I stop doing that in the middle of a deadly pandemic? Right. And then and then other people have said, you know, I'm not going to do that because it's the wrong thing to do, right? Sort of different. How have you thought about that, not just in terms of COVID, but your career? You know, we talk about being a role model. We talk about what sort of messages you put out in your music, how one uses their platform. How have you thought about that?
It's very interesting you would ask that, you know, because before we left on the last tour, the day before the first day of tour, I put up this Instagram post that I was like, it showed us doing a pyro check actually in Austin, not too far from you. And it's like, this is what I would suggest. If you're going to come to a show, be vaccinated and also wear a mask. Is it going to suck? Is it going to be uncomfortable? Yes, but you can do it. And because I wore masks the whole time when I wasn't on stage,
yeah,
you know, except for we're in our tour bus and we were hot. It was outdoors. It sucked.
Yeah.
You know, no doubt about it, but it's what I felt was necessary for us to be able to do this safely. And it was, because there's so many different people with different, like, I don't control a whole tour. You know what I mean? There was another band on there where the front man of the tour had some very different opinions about what was, you know, what was right and what was wrong, or what was real. But I tried to just do to the best of my ability, the right thing to take care of myself and the people around me. And we looked at the situation at the time and it, outdoors, you know, and I don't blame people who didn't come. Some people didn't come to the show because of this.
I would have loved to come. I just couldn't make it work. Yeah.
No, of course not. Right. You know, it felt like, and we made it all the way to end of our tour. We're one of the few bands that did it, you know? And I think that's because the majority of people on the tour were very cautious.
You mean you made it without any cases just blowing up the plans?
Yeah. Like, I mean, there were some crew cases that happened and they immediately isolated, you know, off the tour, put in a hotel for however many days until it can go away. But it was sort of the train left the station. It was very strange. I felt like almost like we were the canaries in the coal mine, like the sort of experiment. And I kind of looked at it in that way. I can try and do my best to do this safely to see if we can pull this off. And we did, you know, we did. And other people, I don't know what happened with other tours, but so I do know some inside stuff that I'm not going to gossip about, you know, that some people caught COVID on other tours because this or that or the other, you know, they weren't cautious. And then, you know, that spread through other things. All I tried to do was control myself and do that to the best of my ability. But it's definitely, there's some self-questioning going on there.
But what I thought was so interesting about the message that you posted is it was bad for business, right? Like you were telling people that to do a thing that was in their interest, but financially, not really in your interest.
No, not in my interest at all. And I'll still speak at things that are not in my financial interest. You know,
but it's interesting how people struggle with that, right? Like it seems obvious. Like why would you tell? But it seems obvious, and yet, like I've been amazed. I've not just been amazed at people who haven't spoken up about things. I'm not just talking about COVID. It's like you have a platform. You should use that platform to say what you think. You know, to make the world a better place, if you like. And then you have people like the person you mentioned, or there's some other musicians who, you know, you sort of think is a person who's tethered to reality or a good person. And then you're like, oh, you not only don't think you have an obligation, you went the other way. Your thing makes the world an actively worse place, right? You're using your platform to spread misinformation or to rile people up or to divide them. It's interesting.
But do people who... Like, so suppose you're a musician and you get up there and you're like, this isn't real. The government is like controlling us. This is all a scam. And, you know, they're putting nanobots in the vaccine or whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah.
Right. Like those people, I don't. And it's hard to look at these people with compassion sometimes. But I think some of those people think they're doing the right thing.
I know.
They believe. And to... It's common sense to me. Obviously the pandemic is real and vaccines work and all this other stuff. It's just common sense, but to sit there and like, I suppose like, I don't know, sit in some sort of high horse of judgment and say, these fucking idiots, like they're spreading this misinformation or whatever. For me, it's kind of an interesting question. It's like, why do you believe this? You know, why, when the evidence is so clearly sits on the other side, you know? But these people do believe it, you know?
I was talking to someone the other day with like a very large platform, like a very famous person. Right. And they were sort of quietly, this was off the record, but they were like, you know, telling some, let's just call it not factual based things, right? Like about COVID, right? Just like, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I'm sort of like, well, you know, here are the facts, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And the response was sort of like, I don't know that much about this, right? And then it's like, then shut the fuck up, right? Like, so it's this interesting thing where people struggle, I think, with stopping and thinking about the implications or the consequences of their words or actions, right? And I think this goes back to what we were talking about with a musician on stage and the crowd getting unruly. It's like, yeah, stopping the show is going to be unpopular and there are risks associated with it. Mm-hmm. But not doing something is also risky. And so how do you, with great power comes great responsibility, I guess, is the old expression.
Yes, it's true. And it's a sticky thing. And it's, you know, we're going to play this festival this weekend. I'm just going to put something up in my Instagram stories because apparently people at that gig were waving their hands and some of them were chanting and all that stuff from the performer's perspective. And I guess there were, what, 50K people at that festival?
Oh, the Astroworld?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was 50K. I mean, we've played audiences twice that size and nothing has happened because, A, we're from a subculture where it may look extremely violent, but everybody takes care of each other.
Yeah.
There's a it's a subculture.
There are rules and an understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. There's an unwritten sort of code. We watch out for each other. But from even in that situation, things can go wrong. And as a performer, being on stage with the lights in your face and all that, it's impossible to keep your eye on 50,000 people all at once.
Sure.
And if people are waving their hands like this, that blends into a whole other crowd, right? So like what I've seen personally that has made me or my bandmates notice when something is wrong is when people go like this over their head, like an X.
Sure. Right?
In Japanese, it's called the batsu. It means something's wrong, you know, or you can't come in here. But that's pretty, it's also an air traffic controller, like stop.
Right.
Or like this over your head. Time out.
People
will notice that, by the way, anyone who's going to a festival, put a big X or the timeout sign over your head if something's the matter. I've noticed it. You know, people just waving their hands and screaming and 50,000 people in the audience, you don't notice anything, you know? So I don't know why I just said that other than I wanted
to get that out there because it's a valuable thing. No, I think what you're saying is you can't afford, like, new events have reminded you of the seriousness of the stakes of the job that you do.
Yes. Yeah.
And so how can you proactively, with the Stoics, how do you proactively communicate ways of avoiding precisely that kind of tragedy and to be able to speak to people or specifically that crowd and go, hey, we're going to get crazy tonight. But if something's the matter, here's how you can communicate that with me.
Yes.
And we can avoid an unnecessary tragedy.
Yes. That's why I said that also, but not put it in such a clear manner as you and base it in stoicism at all. I was just like, I need to get this out of my mind before I forget in case anyone listens to this, put your hands up in an X above your head. You know, it's important.
It's very important. And it doesn't bring the people back who have perished, but it is a way to, it doesn't undo the tragedy, but it prevents us from unnecessarily compounding the tragedy by continuing it.
Right. And also, I keep saying it, but we're part of a subculture where there's rules and so forth. You know, I can only speak to the people that are going to listen to me, you know, and those are the ones that are going to come out and see us. And so for me, it's important to communicate in a clear manner to our audience, you know, not try and, I guess, bring up the Kardashians and say, you should have done this, you know, or whatever.
Sure.
I have to be an effective agent of change within the parameters of my existence.
Within the dichotomy of your control, as the Stoics would say.
Yeah.
So last question, because one of your biggest songs is titled this. It's a theme in your writing. It's a theme, obviously, in heavy metal. And then you've been up close and personal with it. Talk to me about Memento Mori and what that means to you and maybe what you took watching the possibility of your life or your freedom being taken from you, your livelihood being taken from you, which is a form of death in the modern world. What does this idea of meditating on your mortality mean to you?
In my pocket at all times.
There you go. Oh, I love seeing that.
And actually it's my second one because the first one I left in a cab somewhere.
Just hit me up. Hit me up anytime you lose them and I'll replenish.
You're the best. For me, I think the concept Memento Mori, and I'd heard it before I really started tying it with Stoicism. I heard someone told me, he's like, oh, the monks, the ancient monks, the Christian monks would say this, you know, remember one day you too shall die. As I get older, and I'm writing about this in the new book I'm working on some, I think more and more about my mortality because physically I feel it. My body hurts more and more as a 50-year-old man, who still acts like he's 17 on stage. I feel it more and more and more. And, you know, more and more people that are older than me that are either family or friends are dying. So that is bringing my mortality closer to my own face, you know? And I think I see people who try and deal with death, I think, by ignoring it.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's actually a huge problem in our culture now, particularly with elderly people. People put them in a home and lock them away, and whereas they used to die at home.
Right.
You know, and I think we've lost that sort of intimate relationship with death within our families we used to have. So for me, like for instance, my grandma died like 10 days just before the tour started. It's all right. She was 100 years old.
Wow.
Yes.
So she experienced the first pandemic.
Yes. In infancy.
Yes.
But I was with her every day for the last 3 weeks of her life when she went to hospice and all that other stuff. And I watched her slowly decline and I was there and present with her, you know, a family member always was. And I was there the night she died. I spent the night by her side. And it was extremely important to me and to the rest of my family that a family member was there because we don't want to let them die alone.
Sure.
And that's just not the way we are. So for me, being there, it was such an honor to be there because this woman helped raise me so much, you know, to be there and provide some manner, measure of comfort and let her know she wasn't leaving this world alone was so important to me. But it also made me reflect on my own situation. And the whole meditating on death, I think for some people it seems depressing or whatever. And for me, it's just maintaining a firm grasp on reality and trying to, it encourages me to make the most of what time I have here. You know, it really does because it's fleeting. And the more you become aware of mortality, the less time you have to waste on frivolous things, you know, which I spent a lot of time doing. So, and also the sort of iconography of Memento Mori with the skull and all that stuff. Skulls are, I'm in a heavy metal band. It's just cool.
It's part of it. Yeah. No, I think in the Czech Republic, there's a church made
Kutná Hora. I went there after I was pronounced not guilty. I have pictures from it.
People who don't know what we're talking about. It's a church made out of the bones of the monks who served there.
What happened was, there's a couple of ossuaries in here, but what happened is a small, it's like, I don't know, 45 minutes outside of Prague. We took a train there, me and my lawyer, but a priest there back in the day went to the Holy Land, went to Israel, and he came back and he had some soil from Israel and he put it on the church grounds. So everybody wanted to be buried there, right? Because it's holy. So soon the graveyard was filled up. Everybody in the village had died or whatever. And, you know, no more room there. But then the plague came and all these people died and they just dumped all these bodies on the church grounds and they had no more room to bury them. So they just turned them into this incredibly ornate chapel downstairs and upstairs. It's thousands of skulls and so forth, you know, to walk through there. It was really intense to be there.
It'll put your problems in perspective.
Yes. Yes. And that's what it's about, you know, like perspective.
Well, and just to tie it back to your grandmother, again, we say unprecedented times. And it's like, no, there are people who are alive who experienced this exact thing 100 years ago and many times since in the last 100 years and worse.
Yes.
World War One, World War Two, you know, like it's a, there is no normal. Normal is awful in a way, right? Normal is this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%. And it just, I think in our society where this sort of digital society where everybody's glued to their phone, constantly looking for this update of the latest now, like we lose this big picture. We really do. And I find that I remain on a much more even emotional keel when I remember that I am just one small grain of sand in the vast beach that is time. You know, my experience is just one tiny little piece.
That's a beautiful place to stop, man. Look, I'm so glad we got connected and that I got to meet you. And I can't wait to see you on the next tour.
Yes, sir.
My new book, Courage is Calling, is now officially a New York Times bestseller. Thank you so much to everyone who supported the book. It was literally and figuratively overwhelming. We signed almost 10,000 copies of the book, which just, you know, it hit me right here. And I appreciate it so much. If you haven't picked up a copy or you want to pick up a signed copy as a gift, please do. You can get your copy at dailystoic.com/courageiscalling, or you can just go to store.dailystoic.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. Us.